This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you look into your crystal ball 10, 20, 100 years from now, what kind of fuel do you see powering our world? Might it be based on hydrogen, biodiesel, propane, sunshine, seawater, seaweed, something else entirely? Are there environmental concerns connected to even the most futuristic of these? What might those concerns be? These are the kind of questions this hour's guests spend a lot of time trying to answer. One, a professor at James Madison University. The other, until very recently, an activist with the group Virginia Clean Cities. Chris Bachman and Peter Denby are now here to tell us what they've been finding, address your questions, and entertain any ideas you might be willing to offer for where, when it comes to future energy, we should be looking. It's all coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The future of fuel is our focus this hour. How concerned are you about what kinds of energy will be available 10 or 20 years from now? About how much it might cost? About environmental impact? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Christopher Bachman is a professor of integrated science and technology at James Madison University. He is also director of JMU's Alternative Fuels Vehicle Lab. Peter Denby is a volunteer mentor at that lab, a former project director with Virginia Clean Cities, and has just started a new job as a project manager with Antares Group, an alternative fuels consulting company. Chris, Peter, great to have you both back in the Insight Studio.
Tom, thank you so much for having us back. I really appreciate it.
This is great. Glad to be here.
Well, let's get to the tough one first. What's happening with natural gas, and how concerned are each of you about hydraulic fracturing?
Well, natural gas is really taking off here in the United States.
This is Chris Bachman,
and it's a domestic energy resource that has a lot of promise here for America. And it is bringing the cost down and providing fuel that we can produce right here in our own country.
It is. And also propane comes from the same process. And propane has seen a real recent surge in use for transportation as a transportation fuel for a variety of reasons. It's a domestic source, as you said. It's also a heck of a lot cheaper. The project I was just managing, we were deployed 1,200 vehicles, and we saw these fleets saving anywhere between $1 and $1.50 per gallon. These are high-use fleets that are burning 25 to 500,000 gallons of this fuel per month. And so you see a real economic benefit with natural gas and propane.
And that's a great savings, and that's something a lot of folks want, is to be able to save some money. But, of course,
nothing's free.
Nothing is free, and with all good things, they've got their good sides, and they've also got some negatives as well. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly some concern about hydraulic fracturing and the potential environmental and human health effects that could come along with that.
Mm-hmm. Chris Bachman, I understand that you have special reason for concern about what might happen right where you live in Western Rockingham County.
That is true, Tom, and I'm out where very close to where they're looking to tap into the Marcellus Shale play, and that's the shale play that has really boosted the natural gas here in the United States, and that is the area in Virginia, in our state, where that Marcellus Shale play dips into our state and gives us access to it. And so they're looking to poke a lot of holes in the ground out there and to pull out that gas and to provide abundant and inexpensive energy for us. Now, I appreciate that.
At what cost?
Yeah. It'll be cheap monetarily. but I've also seen that movie Gasland, and I don't know if you've seen that movie yet, or Peter, if you've seen it yet. But there's a great scene in there where one of the fellows that lives in an area where they've done the drilling turns on his water tap and then takes a lighter to it and is able to light his water on fire. And although that's a cool trick, Tom, I don't really want to be doing that too much in my own household. So I am concerned about the drilling, and I'm hoping that we can access that gas and that we can make it available to the United States public, but we can do it in a way that we don't disrupt the water supply and don't have these environmental and human health effects, too. I'm definitely concerned about that. My family's out there.
And, you know, hydraulic fracturing is not the only way to get natural gas. That's only the most recent way to get it. There's also nitrogen fracking and other methods, other technologies that don't have quite the waste stream that come from that, but also don't have nearly the yield.
Yeah, the hydraulic fracturing yields have been impressive, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And that's really been a game changer in the energy space. And you may remember T. Boone Pickens and the Pickens plan that was being put forward a while ago, where he wanted to cover the heartland of the U.S. with wind turbines and have clean, renewable wind power for America, something that would last for generations with a really long time frame and very clean.
And much of his concern was getting the U.S. away from imported oil.
It was. And then when hydraulic fracturing, when that new technology to access the gas reserves became available and showed how viable it was, T. Boone had to eat a little crow and change the Pickens plan and wound up going more heavily into the natural gas industry.
For transportation.
And I think in general, too, I mean, he's really supporting this. And sometimes technology can really be a game changer. And I think that's why we're here today, Tom, is to talk about these technologies and how they can really change the game. And hydraulic fracturing definitely changed the game. All of a sudden, a huge amount of energy was available, and monetarily with a very low cost. And it's now made the United States an energy exporter. Mm-hmm. We're actually looking for ways to unload this gas and to sell it to other markets. It's on the world market now, and we're even considering liquefying it and shipping it halfway around the world if people will pay for it.
Well, Peter Bachman, you are a professor of integrated science and technology.
Yeah, Chris Bachman.
I'm sorry, Chris Bachman. I was mixing Peter Denby and yes. Breathing
That's
too much natural gas, I guess. Chris, you, in addition to your work as a faculty member at JMU, you also head up the Alternative Fuels Research Laboratory. You pay a lot of attention to what kinds of fuels are available, and there are many that we have to discuss during the coming hour. But there, I'm sure, are a fair number of people listening who would like to know what you, as a researcher, have seen about the degree to which you think we should be concerned with environmental impact of hydrofracking.
I think the concern is very real there. And in these areas where drilling has occurred, and it's not new to the United States, it's new to our area. But we've been doing a lot of drilling out west in areas like Texas and north of there as well. And we've seen that the towns where the drilling has occurred, that there is leakage in the gas. And they might be getting 99% of the gas that comes out. They might get 95% of the gas. They get most of it. But there's a percentage that gets away from them. And it leaks out into the ground. It leaks out into the air. And that's when we see the problems. The other thing that I didn't pick up on right away was that when they go and they frack in these deep shale plays, you release a lot of substances. It is not just natural gas that winds up coming out through this. And most often, to access those shale plays, you have to drill quite deep. And you wind up drilling through water tables. When they do the frack, especially if they do it with a horizontal drilling bit, you can't control where the fractures go. It's completely random. And if they happen to crack into a water table, then whatever you've released is going to take the easiest route out. A lot of it's going to come up out through your drill, through your well, and you'll get 99% of it, maybe. But a significant amount will make it out to other avenues. And if it gets in the water, even if it's just 1% of what you're releasing, since you're releasing so much, even 1% that gets into the environment, it can be really bad for both the people and other living things that are there.
So the status in Rockingham County right now, as I understand it, please correct me if my understanding is off base, is that there's been something of a moratorium put in place by county government on any drilling, but there is interest on the part of certain energy companies with putting together leases and renting property where they think that drilling might eventually be profitable. I guess what I'm curious about is in this area of western Rockingham County that borders the West Virginia border, out in the areas where your home is, Chris, if your neighbor
got a deal offered from an energy company that said, look, we think we can get you $30,000, $40,000 a year or more for the next 3 or 4 years if you let us drill on our property, on your property. And your neighbor said, well, I think I want to do that. How would you feel about it with these environmental concerns being right next door?
Yeah, it scares the hoot out of me, I'll tell you what. And I can totally appreciate my neighbor making some money off there because everybody wants to make some money. And one of my neighbors, his father lives up in the Pittsburgh area, up in Pennsylvania, and they've seen this drilling happen a little bit ahead of us. And his father leased out some land to be drilled. And the amount of money he was making off of that property was absurd, actually. In 1 month, he got a $30,000 check. At 1 month, he got $30,000 for really doing nothing other than signing this piece of paper. And so I can definitely see the rationale for doing that. But I don't think his dad lives on that property no more either. And if, you know, we leased our property out in our area, and I'm pretty sure we could get a gas lease for the land that I own. I don't think I'd be living on that anymore because of what's going to leak out and what that could potentially do to my family.
But you bring up an interesting point. That's the economic side of this. You know, there's the technology side, there's the environmental side, but there's a big part of it that's the economic side of any alternative fuel. And in my opinion, I think that's where we're really going to see the answer come from, is which fuel can be the most economically viable, because that's what drives the economy. That's what drives the nation. That's what makes the world go round at this point, is the money. That's, that's the motivation behind why we're even doing this.
Yep.
So let me see if I get the name straight this time. Our guest this hour from the Department of Integrated Science and Technology at James Madison University, we have Professor Chris Bachman, as well as a 2002 graduate of Chris's department, and that's Peter Denby. Peter now works as a project manager for the Antares Group, an alternative fuels consulting company. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in phone number, we got some lines open right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. 888-967-2825. We already have some questions posted on our Facebook page. This one's from Carolyn Gentleman. She says, please talk about hydrogen vehicles and solar cells. I saw an article that in California they're working on liquid solar cells that can be painted on surfaces. They were looking at small surfaces, but could that work on something large like the side of a building?
Yeah, now those are some really exciting technologies that could be game changers, just like hydraulic fracturing has been for the natural gas arena. And if they are successful in getting a coating like that, a liquid coating that you could paint on buildings, you've got tremendous potential. And if something like that could work and could prove economically viable, now you've got a real winner on your hands. You know, if you can compete with the fossil fuels with an energy resource that is the same cost and gives you the same performance, but has a reduced environmental impact, I'm pretty sure the population is going to choose that. And if you can make that happen, I think you're going to do well.
But I think the challenge is making that happen. You know, you have technologies like that, but there's a ramp up here. The incandescent light bulb, take that for an example. That took 60 years from when it became commercialized to when it became broadly accepted as the alternative to gas lighting. Mm-hmm. All the while, the gas lighting companies were saying that incandescent lighting gives you freckles, and you're going to surely be electrocuted. But so the challenge there becomes: what do we do? What do we do in our? What's the present look like?
Yeah, and there are some folks here, right here in the Shenandoah Valley. There's a guy in Rockingham County that is working with hydrogen in his vehicle. It's Myron Rhodes, and he's been adding hydrogen to the air intake on his vehicle. He's got a 2006 Dodge Caravan, and he told me he's getting 43 miles per gallon in that Dodge Caravan by adding hydrogen into the air intake. Now, I haven't seen that car in real life yet, but I'm real curious about it. And there are a lot of folks out there, early adopters, if you will, or folks that want to pioneer these new technologies, and they're giving it a go. And hydrogen could be a clean energy resource if you can get it to be cost competitive with the fossil fuels.
The challenge is what do you do today?
Talking about future fuels with Chris Bachman and Peter Denby. We've got some calls coming in. Robert in Rutgersville, you'll be first up when we get back from the break. Steppenwolf, Born to be Wild. Actually, on our Facebook page, WMRA's Virginia Insight, we have a picture of one of our guests looking like he's born to be wild. Peter Denby driving kind of an alternative motorcycle.
Biodiesel-powered trike.
We'll get you to talk about that in a moment. And if anybody is close to their computer, please feel free to take a look at that page. I think it was from a couple years ago when Peter was a little bit younger and more wild. We're going to Rutgersville right now. Robert, thanks for calling in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Your question or comment for Peter Denby and or Chris Bachman, please.
Thanks for taking my call first. And
sure.
I lived through the energy crisis or the gas crisis of the 70s, so why are we discussing this 40 years later? This is nothing more than talk about who can make the most money.
Yep.
In the petroleum and gas industry, it's got nothing to do with clean fuel. Nope. You want to know how to do it? I'll tell you how to do it.
That'd be great.
Okay. First and foremost, when you bail out the auto industry, you don't let them build cars that get 12 miles to the gallon.
Agreed.
You put down guidelines that they make 50 miles to the gallon city,
yep.
Which is doable. Toyota and Honda have been doing it for decades.
Yep, smaller, lighter, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Absolutely.
Every apartment, every office, every house you build, you put a solar panel on to power it.
There you go. Yeah, and make them so that they're energy efficient to boot.
Exactly.
Make them insulated.
You don't need to frack the bejesus out of it.
And I don't want them fracking the bejesus out of it.
You don't need to drill 400 miles off of Virginia's coast so that if, God forbid, what happened in the Gulf of Mexico happens 400 miles off the Atlantic coast.
That's right. That would be devastating
from
here.
Nova Scotia down to Peru.
That would be devastating. Absolutely.
No, Robert, I am just curious. Do you feel like maybe what we need in America then is a monarchy where a king or queen could dictate that we have to do it this way, as opposed to a Congress, which really can't agree on these things, and we seem to have lots of different opinions?
No, what we need to do is what my fine president promised he was going to do and has yet to even make a dent in, is getting lobby money out of the government.
Yeah, did you know
that? The corporations running this country, it's only going to be about one thing and one thing only, and that's gross profit.
770 companies hired 2,300 lobbyists, up 300% in the past 5 years, relating to energy and oil. And I think he brings up a very good point. In part, you know, to his first question about why are we still talking about this, and part of it is because we as a society have such a short-term memory.
Yes, we do.
And,
we do.
You know, as you were commenting, can't remember if we were on the air or not, but, and this is Peter talking, that as soon as, you know, the oil or the price of gas goes up to $4 a gallon and we're freaking out, then it settles down at $3.30 right now, I think is what it is. And we're like, oh, man, it's finally back within range.
Yes.
When 2 years ago, $3.30 would have. Cause an uproar.
Yeah.
I am sort of curious about, and by the way, Robert, thank you so much for your call. I don't know that either of you, Peter Denby or Chris Bachman, can answer this, but as you travel around Virginia, the difference in gasoline prices, because that $3.39 price that you're referring to, Peter, I think is in the Harrisonburg area right now, and people in Charlottesville are paying $3.60-something. And a few weeks ago, it was flipped around a little bit. It was 20 cents less in Charlottesville than in Harrisonburg or some other places. And I have no idea why gas prices vary across the Commonwealth the way they do. If there's somebody listening who wants to add that in the discussion, you're welcome to chip in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Peter Denby and Chris Bachman, both affiliated with the alternative fuels research going on at James Madison University, are our guests. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Doug, thanks for reaching us there. And Doug's question, how do we inform the masses of the dirtiness of natural gas production? while it is being promoted as a clean alternative. Chris?
That's a very complicated issue. There's a lot of money to be made, and the folks that are going to make that money want to put it in the best light possible, and they have already promoted some of the good aspects. If you were to measure tailpipe emissions, it's cleaner, and that's what they are getting out to the public, and they have a lot of money to be able to buy time on television, on radio, etc. The environmental impacts, there isn't really a lot of money to be made there, and people don't have the money to buy that airtime and compete with that to bring those to light. So it's very challenging. A lot of those the education there comes at a more grassroots effort. And that film that I mentioned, Gasland, wonderful movie. And just because I love it so, I'll give a free promo for it. Anybody who lives anywhere near where they're going to tap it should take a look at that film. That was made by a regular individual, a citizen, guy, just like you or me. And he had been offered a lease for his property. He had been offered $100,000 to lease his land. And he was contemplating whether or not he should do it, and so he visited the areas that had already been drilled just to see what would happen to his land. And he did not intend on making the film. He got sucked in. He got sucked in once he saw the first place and all the problems that people were having. He decided, shoot, he was up in, I believe it was New York, right by the New York-Pennsylvania border, and he got sucked in, and he decided to travel out west to see some of the areas where the fracking began and to see how they look now. And he brought his camera with him and he just filmed it all. And by golly, it blew me away. They fracked the bejesus out of that land. And hey, it's producing a lot of gas, but it's producing a bit of problems too. So we do have to educate the public about it. And we got to let everybody know what's going to happen. The thing that also makes it challenging, it's relatively few people that are directly affected with the negative impacts. And it's a relatively large number of people that wind up reaping the benefit of that. And for Virginia, case in point, you have a large population in Richmond, Norfolk, Northern Virginia, D.C. area. They won't see the environmental problems. In contrast, there are relatively few people that live out in Criders or Berkton or Folks Run. We'll see that impact directly. But if you looked at overall numbers, there's much fewer of us than there are.
So what you're saying is there's a huge population will gain economic benefit while a small percentage of the population, in many cases hidden off in a corner someplace, will deal with the pollution and health problems. And to get back, Chris Bachman, to Doug's question on Facebook, when he's talking about natural gas really being dirty as opposed to its image that is being sold as clean. Mm-hmm. Let me check something I think you said. It, in fact, is cleaner in terms of what's coming out of the tailpipe, but it's the drilling process that's dirty.
Correct. And the drilling process for conventional oil can be dirty, too, as we saw in the Gulf, when they're trying to tap resources that are much more challenging to get to than resources that we're used to.
On Facebook, we have this question from Maureen, who says, please talk about any current info on using algae to create fuel. I was impressed with the possibilities, including that algae can be clean and largely pollution-free while creating fuel. Is research going on to how to make this resource economically feasible?
There's a lot of research going on this, and fortunately, ExxonMobil is getting behind it too and have put up $600 million to advance that effort. And the U.S. Navy is extremely interested in the algae-based fuels and recently ran a ship on algae-based fuels. They've powered aircraft on algae-based fuels recently, and we're seeing the cost of those going down as well. For me, algae is one of the best alternative fuel options if we can get it to work in a large enough volume. You know, I mentioned that we ran a Navy ship on it, that we've run airplanes on it, but really one or two ships and one or two airplanes, that's not going to satisfy our transportation demand that we have. And that's been a real challenge, is how do we scale it up?
Is this a creation of some sort of biofuel?
Absolutely. This is biofuel 100%.
Can you describe anything of how it works? I mean, you go out in the ocean and you start scooping up algae or what?
Yeah, and that's really the idea, is that you could do this production offshore, and there's a lot of surface area out there where we're getting a lot of sunlight coming down. These algae absorb CO2, which is a problematic gas for us. We're concerned about it. They use the sunlight to rearrange the carbon molecules. They make oils. They make sugars. And then you, in turn, process those into biofuels. And it's almost like the holy grail of clean, renewable energy resources. It's like millions of little solar panels out there in the ocean that self-assemble at little or no cost, and they repair themselves if they get damaged, and they absorb gases that we think are harmful, and then they give us energy to boot.
You know, Tom, this is Peter. I'd like to, you know, I think there are a lot of emerging technologies that are really interesting, and I think there's a lot of potential there. But I'd also like to not lose sight of where we are today either. You know, algae fuels, what would you say, Chris? What's a reasonable timeline to when those might be big enough to make an impact?
50 years or
yeah.
more.
You know, the solar cells you can paint on a car. What would you think that would be?
Comparable. That's
yeah.
a ways off.
And the problem is that we have a real issue right now in our society as a global society, as a global economy, as far as use. Per capita, the United States population uses most energy, pales in comparison to what China and India are working toward. Mm-hmm. I recently read that if China and India combined use the same per capita energy of those in the United States, it would take the resources of four planet Earths
yes.
to sustain yeah. that.
And you know they're going in that route too. And this is where things really are going to get tight. You know, India and China are both increasing their oil refining capacity. I think mm-hmm. India went up 20%, China mm-hmm. went up 10%. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the scenario, this is where we're going to be in a pinch. You've got 40% of the world's population in U.S., China, and India. That's 40% of the world. Mm-hmm. And we're China and India especially are very much increasing their energy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And we're consuming quite high. All of us are going to be done with the oil resources, even if we drill off of Virginia, even mm-hmm. if we drill in Anwar.
Mm-hmm.
Those three nations are going to burn all of their oil in the next 10 to 20 years. It'll be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have 40% of the world that commands...
lights off.
lights off car in the garage.
Well, I know that, Peter, one of the things that you want to talk about is a transition fuel that gets us into a better place mm-hmm. before we can get to the image of 50 years ago that Chris was sharing with us of possibly algae or mm-hmm. solar paint or mm-hmm. something else. But I was just about to take Anna's call from Woodstock, and we lost the call. Anna, I don't know if you had to go or for some reason our system cut you off. We'd love to get your question back. If you have time to call us back, please do call at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or, as Doug and Maureen did, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Peter Denby, you think the big promise for a transition fuel is a kind of natural gas called propane?
Well, to clarify, I think that there are a lot of promises with transition fuels. There are a variety of technologies that you can put in your car. Pretty much just put in your car right now with minimal changes to the vehicle, and it gets you going. And in a lot of cases, it even saves you money. Propane and natural gas are two of those fuels that you can do that to. For $5,800, you can put a kit and an additional tank on your vehicle, on your gasoline-powered vehicle, and run propane. And you can get propane for $1 to $1.50 less per gallon than what you are now. It has maybe 10% less energy density, so you get 10% worse fuel economy, but it's more than made up in the difference. But the point of what you're asking, Tom, is right, though, that there has to be a path to get from where we are to where we want to be. The future is not something that's we're just going to arrive at. It's something that we have to create, and we as a society have to find a way to get to these renewable fuels, to these cleaner fuels. But this stuff is not going to happen overnight. It took, you know, petroleum oil-based fuels has 100-150-year head start on us
yeah.
on a somewhat uneven economic playing field. And so there has to be some serious changes in our behavior, in our state of mind, in our policy, in our government, in order to get to a state of where we can have these real alternatives.
Alternative fuel advocates as well as researchers, Peter Denby and Chris Bachman, both have an association with James Madison University, and they are our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. If you want to talk to them, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. James in Edinburgh, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Peter or Chris, please.
Well, thank you for having the show on. Excellent discussion. I have to agree with everything that's being said, especially the lockdown politically by the lobbying people, which is putting a cramp on research in alternative energies. We got to the moon
right,
really, really fast by saying we were going to do it.
Yep, we did.
And I think we can do that if we really take the shackles off of these guys that have it, you know, all around. Mm-hmm. One comment I'd have to say about the algae fuel.
Mm-hmm.
You saw what happened to the price of food when they started doing soy diesel.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the ecological imbalance from harvesting too much algae could be really hurting, but I don't know.
Yeah, and that's a great point, actually. I mean, the algae, the microalgae that are out in the ocean now, the ones that exist now, are really the basis of the food chain. They're the foundation. If you don't have the algae, you don't have an ecosystem. And
right.
I definitely would not want to harvest that algae. It is tremendously important for so much diverse life in the ocean. What struck me when I was looking more into it, and I think if you go onto the NASA webpage, you can see maps where they show you where the ecosystems are. And about 75% of the ocean is largely uninhabited by creatures you can see with the naked eye. There's some bacteria and stuff out there, but there's really not much life. That's 75% of the ocean is really a wet desert, and it doesn't have the nutrient there to grow the algae. And without the algae, nothing else blossoms. Nothing else grows there either. So one of the ideas we've been looking into is could you take excess nutrient and nutrient that creates harmful problems like algal blooms in the Chesapeake Bay. And there's abundant life already, or there was abundant life there. And the algae blooms were problematic. Well, could you shift those nutrients now and put them in an area where an ecosystem does not exist currently so that you wouldn't be interfering with that life system and grow these algae intentionally for fuel production, for biofuel production, in an area where there's nothing there to disrupt.
James, when I was an itty-bitty little fellow maybe 40 years ago, if you had asked me to look into the future of transportation, I would have told you for sure that I was going to be flying through the sky in my car back and forth to work every day. I wonder if you look into the future 30 or 40 years, if you have a sense of what your wildest dream of transportation and fuel use might look like.
Oh, tough to say. But I have another question.
Sure.
How come nobody works on cryogenics as in the superconducting electric system and or seeing as all internal combustion engines are based on the fact that a gas is expanding and cryogenic nitrogen expands more than any gasoline when it turns back to gas? How come they aren't?
I see some nodding heads among our guests, but I also see the clock on the wall telling us we have to pause for a break. So, James, I'm going to ask Peter and Chris to address your question when we get back from the break. In the meantime, I really want to thank you for joining us here on Virginia Insight. We will return with this discussion about future fuel in just a bit more than 1 minute.
Take a ride.
group They Might Be Giants, titled, oddly enough, Electric Car. Chris Bachman heads up the Alternative Fuels Vehicle Lab at James Madison University. He's also an associate professor of integrated science and technology at JMU. Peter Denby serves as a volunteer mentor at that JMU Vehicle Lab. His brand new day job is as a project manager for the alternative fuels consulting firm, the Antares Group. 888-WMRA Talk, our phone number here on Virginia Insight, if you have a question or comment for alternative fuels advocates and researchers Chris and Peter. And we are, Peter, going to get to you about electric cars in a moment, but first we have to finish up with James' question, which I guess goes to you, Chris Bachman, about cryogenic fuels.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah. That's a very cool idea. And I haven't really heard of too much activity in that area. And I think what he's referring to is that liquid nitrogen or some of these other liquids that are very, very cold will expand rapidly and could drive an engine or vehicle. I think the challenge, though, is that it takes a lot of energy to get those compounds into that liquid state, into that ultra-cold state. There isn't very much on our planet that exists at that temperature, and we actually put a lot of energy in to make those substances get that cold. So I don't think you get out as much as you put in.
Peter Denby, what is happening with the future of electric cars?
I am a very firm believer in electric transportation. I think it solves or it addresses a lot of the issues that we have. But I'm also not saying that it's ready for 100% of the population right now either.
And Peter, you've built,
I've built four electric vehicles.
Okay.
And had a blast driving them. But electric vehicles they address two very key things that we face with the challenges of transportation. One is fuel source. Electric vehicles can take electrons that are produced from renewables such as wind and solar and tidal and thermal.
Or nuclear, coal, or current technologies, wood, coal, nuclear.
And wherever else, as long as you make those electrons, that car will take. Yeah. It doesn't matter. And then the other thing that the electric cars address is infrastructure, whereas if you have a natural gas vehicle or you have a hydrogen vehicle or whatnot, you have to have the refueling infrastructure to do it.
But you were driving your electric vehicles to JMU as a student, I think, even.
From Stanton. And so with electric vehicles, you can plug it in your garage in the evening and it's ready to go.
Now, Peter, you did some calculations, if I recall, where you were trying to figure out, did it cost you more or less money to drive the darn thing?
So,
and what did you come up with?
Well, my other vehicle at the time was a 2001 Ford F-150 V8 pickup truck.
Okay, so a nice small car.
Nice small car. I used to pull my race car. And then the vehicle I was comparing against was the other end of the spectrum, which was a little electric scooter that I converted to drive around city driving, where my truck was by far the least efficient. And my truck costs about 25 cents a mile city to drive, and the electric scooter costs 0.2 cents per mile to drive.
Wow, yeah, big difference. But I think that also illustrates the point that you got to have a small, light vehicle.
Yeah, the lifestyle is the big component. That's where EVs may not be ready for everybody right now.
Yeah.
You know, the electric scooter worked for me because I could afford it, because it was a little dinky electric scooter, and I looked like a great in my little helmet driving around town on it. Not great, but I couldn't go out and buy a new electric vehicle right now to supplement my normal transportation. But for over half of this country's population, they don't drive more than 100 miles in a day anyhow, and it would be perfect. But it's the behavior change, the society's frame of mind that becomes really challenging, and that's where transition fuels we were talking about earlier, Tom, like the natural
Before
gas and
get
the propane.
Back to that, James has been holding on for a while.
Hi, James.
He's been driving somewhere along Interstate 81. We're not sure in what vehicle, but we understand he has pulled off so he can speak with us safely. James, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Peter Denby and or Chris Bachman, please.
Hi, how are you doing? My name's James McPherson. I'm actually from Blacksburg and heading back that way now. I've been listening to your show, and it's great. You got a couple things I'd like to point out. On number one, the algae. Even years ago when algae started, one of the great things about that was they were going to use it to clean sewer waters and industrial waste out.
That's true. They had a lot of nutrient in those.
It was a huge plus to use these nutrients up and get them out of the water systems and being able to recycle them.
Absolutely.
another, and now listen, I'm a big carbon footprint. I've used a lot of fuel in my life, but and it's, I tell you what, we're not there on these alternatives, and you've got another problem you hadn't addressed, and that is the rules and the regulations.
True.
The people that are out here trying to do this stuff, I love it. Like the guy putting the nitrogen in his gasoline engine. But I guarantee you, if he gets pulled over by DOT, he's going to get a ticket.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
I think it was actually hydrogen you were talking about.
Yeah. Excuse me, hydrogen, you're right.
But you're right.
He's going to have a problem. I know of a couple of instances, people making their own diesel.
Absolutely.
Have been shut down because.
Yep. Yeah, that happened out your way, too, down Blacksburg.
Yes, over in Floyd.
Yep.
And, we've got a long way to go, so to get to where we need to be. But my first question is, if the natural gas is so much there, and we've got a 1% problem, why don't we spend some time and get that 1% fixed so we can use this natural gas?
I hear you there. And this is Chris Bachman here. I think that as we advance this drilling and we harness that energy resource, I think all of the people that are getting behind it, like our congressman for the Shenandoah Valley, Bob Goodlatte, just put forward legislation, the Pioneer Act, that's going to help open up oil and gas drilling. And I think that our congressman and our governor, Bob McDonnell, is also very much in favor of harnessing the natural gas. I think both of those fellows would want us to harness all of the gas. I don't think either of them want us to do it in a sloppy fashion. They both operate efficiently and effectively, and they would want us to be the same in the way we harness that gas.
I need to ask a question about that,
though. Based on what I heard you say before, Chris Bachman, and by the way, James, thank you so much for your comments and your question. You have pointed out that in most of the places where there is this shale gas available to be drilled, they tend to be rural with not a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be horrible environmental and health impacts on those few people, but they are a few, while a much wider community, and I think you talked about the entire state of Virginia, benefiting economically from the boon of this kind of drilling, as well as the fact that if they use the natural gas in such abundant supply, the price that the entire society is going to pay is going to be much less. And then you mentioned the friend of yours who I think had a lease on some of his property in Pennsylvania. He got as much as $30,000 in 1 month for land that had just been sitting there. So if on the one side you've got all of these people benefiting in so many different ways, all of this money being made or savings for different people who are benefiting versus a few people who get hurt really badly because of environmental negative impact.
Mm-hmm.
Are we as a society going to worry enough about those few people who are getting hurt?
That's a great question, Tom. And if it was put to vote and everybody was allowed an equal vote and an equal voice, then the majority that would not feel those environmental impacts would win. And that's pretty much what's happening now. The unfortunate side of it is if you appreciate the natural landscape in the areas, or if you are a citizen there, maybe you've had a family living in that area for generations, then that land is going to be ruined. This is a lot of national land. It's Bureau of Land Management land that is being utilized for this. This is essentially everyone's land. This is my land, and it's your land too. And it is, in essence, getting destroyed. And I had another friend that was in the natural gas business years ago when he was a younger fella. He's now in his 70s. And he had gone out to Wyoming. He always wanted to go to Cody. He's kind of a cowboy, and he always wanted to go out there. And he did. And because of his previous experience in the natural gas industry, he wanted to see what it was like, what they were doing out there. And basically, he was really disappointed. He said it was a mess out there, that they were hiring anybody. Just as long as you had a heartbeat, you qualified. That they were taking these 18-year-old kids that aren't necessarily sure which end of the screwdriver to use, and then they're putting them on a drill rig and saying, go to it and get some gas out. And
it sounds like what you're saying is money and economic benefit for me is going to trump harm to you as long as there's more of me than there are you.
And there's also fast money to be made. People are realizing that the gas is down there, and whoever gets it out gets the money. And so they're it's like the Wild West out there. They're just poking as many holes, pulling it out as fast as they can, hoping that they're the ones that get the cash in there.
Before we depress too many more people, we've had Philip waiting on the line for a bit, so let's see what he has to say. Philip, thanks for calling in from Harrisonburg. Your question, your comment for Peter Denby and or Chris Bachman, please.
I just had a sort of general question. It was mentioned that there was work being done with alternative fuels and sort of the airline and other forms of transportation. But what sort of struck me lately is that we sort of lag behind in train transport and other types mm-hmm. of mass transport. Mm-hmm. And wondering how this alternative fuel can apply more towards mass transport and also what the timeline is of really how long it would take for us to be effective in producing enough to make it a viable resource.
Chris, I think that's a really interesting question.
This is Peter.
And I was actually just getting ready to ask Chris when he was talking here about just overall energy efficiency. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where public transit and mass transit really, really helps, where you don't, a train still uses diesel. Most trains in the States still use diesel. But because of the amount of people or goods that they are moving, mm-hmm. there's an efficiency standard.
Yeah, part of that there. Problem is the way we've developed our land, where mm-hmm. we have created these suburbs, which have been very enjoyable for a lot of folks that wanted to get out of the city, mm-hmm. that maybe wanted to get out of urban or industrialized areas. And we've expanded in the United States
so that they live in a place where they don't have easy access to trains? Is that part of what you're saying?
There's not enough people there to make a train track worthwhile.
Philip's question, let me clarify, Philip. Are you asking about whether more people could somehow be using mass transit, or are you asking could there be more environmentally friendly fuels being used by vehicles like trains and planes?
More along the lines of the second. But just sort of in general, the technology seems to be lagging speed-wise as well. Are there any benefits that this fuel has on the economy or the speed of the trains and that sort of thing? Is there a weight difference and
speed's
and
really
like that
at this point,
benefit?
Gentlemen, not a function of the fuel, is it? It's the function of the type of rails and types of trains running on the rails
for the most part.
Yeah, and this is Chris Bachman here and. There is biodiesel that is essentially, if it's made properly, is essentially a drop-in solution that works with the trains, the buses, and the mass transit system. So mm-hmm. you can run any diesel engine essentially on biodiesel. And there's a great model here in Winchester area. It's Shenandoah Ag Products, and it's a group of farmers that are growing canola in the winter. Specifically, as a cover crop, specifically so that they can harness that oil. And then they don't want to mess with that food versus fuel debate either. They're cognizant of that. And so they sell the oil to restaurants in the Winchester area so the restaurants can be proud that they're using a locally produced oil for their food products and their fryers, et cetera. And then Shenandoah Ag Products also goes and picks up that oil as a waste product because you're not supposed to put oil into your normal trash stream, your normal waste stream. And normally you pay someone to come get it. So Shenandoah Ag goes around and they recollect that waste oil. So it's gone through the food system, if you will. Then they bring it back as a waste and then they convert it into biodiesel, into fuel. And that fuel can be used in the tractors mm-hmm. and the irrigation systems to help support that agriculture. And,
but not enough for trains quite yet.
Not enough in volume.
Well, but I can give, this is Peter, I can give Philip a very specific example of what he's talking about. And that's,
can you do it quickly?
I can. The Hampton Roads Transit Authority down in Hampton Roads, Virginia, switched all, if not all, of their public transit buses to run natural gas. And as a result, they're cleaner, they're much quieter. They've been much more, except they don't blow soot everywhere every time they take off. And that's a real good solution.
I'm going to stop you there because we've got one other person who's been waiting for the longest time. Philip, thank you so much. Benjamin, I'm sorry, we are almost out of time, but if you could get to your question quickly, please.
Yes, thank you. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more specifically about the impact of the fracking procedure.
You're talking about environmental impact specifically, Benjamin?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, Chris Bachman, you started on this. You got 30 seconds to sum up what the concerns are about the environmental impact of hydrofracking.
If the fracks go in the wrong place, then you can ruin your water and you can ruin the air too. And so that's kind of the general.
Is there a way, although perhaps more expensive, to conduct this kind of drilling without these environmental problems, or do we simply not know enough yet to be able to protect the environment as we're doing it?
I think we don't know enough yet, but I believe that we can get that gas and we can do it in a clean and safe manner.
Benjamin, thanks so much for being our final caller from Crozet here on Virginia Insight. Our guests have been from James Madison University, Chris Bachman, director of JMU's Alternative Fuels Vehicle Lab, as well as Peter Denby, a volunteer mentor at that lab and project manager for the alternative fuels consulting firm, the Antares Group. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Tom, thank you. And I think we really just have to make some choices here as to how our future is going to shape up. And we can choose to be clean and renewable, or we can choose to continue down the path that we've been going down.
And we have to choose to have you back when we've got more than 3 seconds left.
That would be great.
Thanks.